Hello and welcome to Into the Wild, a podcast dedicated to bringing all the nature and wildlife chat with top animal industry guests. On this week's show, I spoke with biologist, broadcaster and author, Professor Adam Hart. Adam has always had a love for science and nature, sending him around the world to study all kinds of animals. However, we promised each other a chat about bugs. Adam has done a lot of work with social insects, including setting up an active data study, the Big Wasp Survey. If you enjoy bees, ants and wasps, then this episode is for you. So sit back, grab a tea or a coffee, and enjoy the show. Hi, Adam. Thanks so much for joining me on today's show. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks, actually. Yeah, it's good weather at the moment, which is definitely helping. I think if it was pretty grey and dismal outside, it wouldn't be helping. But yeah, at the moment, I'm not too bad.
Oh, God, yeah, exactly. I said that the other day. If this was raining at the moment, I'd be losing my nut. Like, I'd be just pacing around the house and looking at, like, Google images of lovely environments. You know what I mean?
I'm doing that as well. But yeah, I can look out the window at the same time. So multimedia.
What I will say as well, and also to my listeners, I don't think I've told my listeners this yet, I am currently locked down on a boat, on a narrow boat, and I can hear a boat going past now. So if at any point you hear some random noises like that, that's what that is. Just thought I'd throw that out there in case you're like, where is this man?
Whereabouts are you? Which canal system are you on?
So we're in Greenford, so not far from Uxbridge, and kind of just north of Richmond, really. So we're on the, I guess it counts as the Thames, is it?
So is it quite kind of countryside, rural? You know, you're not in the middle of town type of canal.
Yeah, for London, I'd say it's rural. There's certainly people and vehicles around, but there is also greenery as well, and there's lots of wildlife. But I do say that, I mean, there's wildlife around. We've got, like, coots and loads of coot nests, and we've got moorhens, you've got ducks, you've got the fish that jump out of the water in the evening, which is great to watch. But it is London wildlife, so it's all got a bit of an attitude about it, do you know what I mean?
It's a mellow way to watch wildlife on the water, though.
Oh, God, it's lovely, nice. Isn't it? There's just so much going on, like, of an evening, about 6 o'clock, we just all sit out there, and it's just like, this is nice, do you know what I mean? But I thought I'd just explain that, just in case there's, like, another boat goes by and you're like, is everything all right? But thanks so much for joining me on the show. I was reading up on your career, which is just incredible, the things you've done. And the question I always ask to my guests on these shows, which is a question we ask to everyone in the nature world, I think, but it's always interesting to hear the answers, is where did your interest in wildlife and the natural world and animals begin? When did that start for you?
You know, it's kind of one of those things where I never remember a time when I wasn't. So I grew up in South Devon. It was a very sort of, you know, I went rock falling. My parents were into kind of stuff like that. We had quite a nice garden. I was kind of always in the woods or doing stuff. I can never really remember a time when I wasn't into nature, you know. And I'd pick up caterpillars off nettles and all kinds of bits and pieces. And there was always, you know, some sort of ill thought through kind of project. I probably thought of it in my mind as sort of research, but actually it was just something rotting in the corner. But you know, there was always that kind of vibe going on. You know, if I found stuff, I'd bring it back. And yeah, my dad worked in a lab and was involved in kind of some sampling and surveying. So he'd bring back the odd kind of thing in alcohol or something. You know, it'd be some sea urchin or something. And so I don't know. I've kind of always just had that sort of love of nature, and I was always into science, and you know, I love other sorts of science, and it all mixes in together, you know, and physics is sort of underpins chemistry, which underpins biology, so I kind of love all that sort of stuff, and you know, space and all that kind of thing. But it, for me, it always comes back down to biology and back down really, I guess, to nature and to wildlife, just because I can never remember a time when I wasn't, you know. It's always been there, really.
Yeah, that's great. I agree, really. It's kind of like, as someone from myself that's similar minded, it's kind of, it has always been there, and it is trying to think of that moment of, not when did it start, when was it not a thing, kind of, because no matter where I've been in my life, it's like I want to be around nature. Was there a certain, like, animal or field of nature that you really kind of got hooked on as a kid, or was it like insects or anything like that that just kind of like really intrigued your brain?
It was kind of all of it, really. But it's funny, really, because I think when I think back, there's probably, I used to enjoy birds, and I still do, and you know, I love walking around, like, near me, I can within about 10 minutes be in a field where skylarks are singing at the moment, for instance. Oh, wow. And you can see them, and you know, there's sparrowhawks going around, and I'm not very far from area where goshawks are found, and you can find them. So I love birds, and when I go abroad, I'm always keen to kind of find out what birds are around. And I remember back to when I was a kid, and you you know, we had a bird table in the back garden, and I can remember a buzzard landing on it once, which was a real kind of moment.
Oh,
we had woodpeckers and stuff like that, yeah, which was kind of cool. And then I think back, and it's probably insects as well. I think almost certainly, because there were a lot of them around. I sort of say that to people, you know, if you want to go and I love big wildlife, right? I spend a lot of time in South Africa, for instance, and Southern Africa, and I love, you know, seeing all that stuff, buffaloes and elephants and things. But actually, wherever you are, you can normally find some invertebrates. So, you know, they are cool. And when you're little and you're sort of grubbling around, you've got the right scale for that sort of life.
Yeah.
You know, you see them better, and they're kind of bigger and more exciting when you're small. So I guess those sorts of strands, probably, you know, invertebrates and kind of big wildlife, I look back and I can remember. Yeah, reading Willard Price books, for instance, your African adventure and deep sea adventure and stuff, and it was that kind of side of things. And then, you know, along with that, the sort of insects and stuff that you'd find in the back garden. And yeah, luckily my parents didn't kind of freak out if I appeared with a slug or something. You know, they'd be like, "Oh, that's very nice." But maybe outside, I can vaguely remember having big sweet jars. You know, those sort of plastic sweet jars you used to get with a kind of
straw. Yeah, lights. Yeah.
With kind of holes in the top. I think I had some stick insects in there, which I vaguely remember releasing because they were breeding really quickly. And I think in a very ill thought through release program, I released them, and it was sort of South Devon, and it was quite warm. And I can remember at the end of the summer still seeing a couple of them in the sort of outside. Fortunately, we had a very stiff winter, which obviously, you know, killed them off, and I wasn't responsible for a sort of accidental accidental introduction. But yeah, I kind of have that sort of that memory of kind of having quite a hands-on sort of childhood when it comes to wildlife and nature. I think that just really helped. We had a pond in our garden as well, which
that always helps.
Actually, once I did fall into it. I can remember throwing a rope over a tree. I imagine I was probably Indiana Jones or something, and I started to climb up the rope, and the rope was not rated for even my fairly feather weight at the age of nine, and I did tumble down into the pond and crashed. I can remember walking in, like half of me soaked from sort of probably sort of mid kind of torso down, just soaking wet with like bits of pond weed, and my mum just looked at me and she said, "I don't know what you've been doing, but I suggest you get changed." And it's like, yeah, fair enough. So yeah, I had that. You know, I can remember that kind of hands-on sort of, you know, getting involved with wildlife and nature quite early on.
Really. I love the fact that really made me laugh when you just said that in that stick insect story, because I had stick insects as well as a kid, and you just going, "I wasn't responsible for anything." Like just letting these insects go or something like that. That really made me laugh.
And they're tiny as well. When they come out, it's great, but there's so many of them. And the great thing with stick insects is that they really do breed very well too when you've got them.
Yeah, it doesn't take much.
You kind of rapidly end up with a population problem, which again, yeah, it's all good knowledge and learning, I suppose. But
yeah, absolutely. Well, we've promised each other, I think when we were arranging the chat, we were promising each other chat about insects. We both said to that, you know, it's quite often on this podcast and a lot of nature shows we chat about large mammals or, you know, the cute and the cuddly, but we both said to each other, let's talk about insects. I think that's something that you're specialized in, and you were we talk about the big wasp survey. That's something you worked on in 2017. What did that involve?
Yeah, well, that's still ongoing, actually. So that's the citizen science campaign. So the idea is I worked with Siren Sumner down at University College London. She tweets as Wasp Woman. And together we set up the Big Wasp Survey. And the idea was to get people, you know, the public, to help us get some data on wasps and long-term data, because we actually don't have that much information about wasp distribution and about wasp abundance through time. We've got a few nice studies, but across the country there wasn't much there. So we got people to put out wasp traps, which is, again, it was kind of controversial at the time. We got a bit of a flack in the press for it, but it led to some interesting things. But the idea is that people will put out a wasp trap for a small amount of time. They survey. It's only worker wasps. I think to this point, we've only caught one queen out of many, many thousands of wasps that we've had in. So it doesn't have any effect on the sort of population next year. And the idea is that we can identify them. They send in the wasps. So you sort of, it's a fairly involved thing. It's not just a case of I saw a wasp and you go online. You know, you actually have to do something, build this trap, put it out, follow the protocol properly, send us the samples. We then identify those samples and put together sort of distribution maps and stuff. So we've been doing that 2017, 18, 19, we did it. We'll be hoping to do it this year as well. We've got sort of a network now of kind of dedicated wasp trappers that have been sampling for us repeatedly year on year out for since 2017. And that's really valuable. You know, you get the same site, couple of traps out, gives us real kind of statistical power over time. So we're hoping that we'll be able to do that again this year. I've got a student at the moment who's working on a really neat kind of web-based portal for people to identify their own wasps. So to do all the identification themselves and send us the data, or they can send us the wasps. So hopefully we'll be getting that out towards the end of the summer. Obviously, you know, things are all a bit up in the air at the moment, but it shouldn't really affect what we want to do, and may even, you know, well, who knows where we'll be by the end of August. But yeah, fingers crossed that the Big Wasp Survey will be able to go ahead, because it's really, really useful when you've got this kind of long-term data set that goes on.
Yeah, absolutely. And once the data's collaborated over a good few years, what kind of things is that going to hopefully be able to show you in regards to wasps in the UK?
Yeah, well, what we're hoping is to be able to see some sort of pattern in abundance, to see distribution. There's lots of different species, so we're interested in the social wasps, and there's a fair few of those, sort of 6, 7, 8 of them that we get trapped in. So we're hoping to see how they change their distribution and just get some baseline data in, because, you know, everyone's sort of very aware of things like insect declines and stuff. But actually, when you look at the data, one of the biggest problems we have is we really don't have that much long-term data on insect populations. We have very few studies across long-term. We've got almost no geographical spread. Most of them are focused on particular groups of insects. So it's really adding into that kind of data set. But, I mean, so far, out of the first sort of year or so, what we were able to show is that actually 2 weeks of citizen science effort, actually only really a week, because people put the traps out for really just a week at the end of August, we were able to get the same sort of level of resolution in terms of distribution maps as can be got by about 4 decades of sort of professional, if you like, sort of non-citizen science approaches trying to look across it. So it's a very quick way of doing it. It's not a particularly easy way of doing it. The big stumbling block for us is that if we don't get those identifications spot on, then the data are no good. So we wanted everyone to send those wasps in. So what happens then is that we get, you know, freezers full of envelopes with wasps in that have to be identified, and that is a big problem, and that's why we're looking at trying to get people to do that themselves. But yeah, the idea is that over time we'll end up with a really nice kind of data set that starts to nail down what's actually happening, because wasps are hugely important. You know, they're actually useful pollinators, they're great pest controllers, all this kind of stuff, and we tend to focus on the, you talked earlier about the cute and cuddly wildlife, and that we're focusing on insects. Well, actually, in insects, people tend to focus on the cute and cuddly ones there as well. So everyone loves bumblebees, and you know, honeybees make honey, and butterflies are beautiful, and ladybirds, and then kind of people's interest sort of wanes a little bit. Many millions of species. So yeah, there's in the UK alone, I know you've talked to Erica McAllister, I think, before, haven't you?
Yes, yeah, I did. Yeah,
NHM. Yeah. I mean, you know, she's a fly, a dipterist. I mean, I think there's something like 7,000 species of fly in the UK. You know, you ask people how many types of flies are there, you might be able to get people to go, well, you know, there's the big one that bothers you, and there's like crane flies, and you know, you might get people up to 3 or 4, and there's actually, you know, many, many thousands. So it's trying to get people kind of, you know, engaged with those things that are a bit less fluffy but really important. That's hard.
Well, that's exactly, and I think that's the same with wasps as well. I mean, people think they hate wasps, but actually I think what they're on about is the common wasp. I think that's something that they're, that, you know, when they say they did this, like, it's the one, and I can't remember the actual name of it, but you might be able to correct me there.
Well, Vespina vulgaris is the little kind of common wasp, the yellow jacket kind of thing.
Yellow jacket,
the yellow
it.
And black one. The one that classically bothers you towards the end of the summer, right? And bothers me as well, right? There's, you know, they are quite nuisance sometimes. But an interesting thing, I've sat in pub beer gardens before. You remember those back in the,
day. Yeah, what are they again?
A pub, yes, I remember that. You sit in a pub beer garden, particularly like this time of year, in late April, beginning of May, and you'll have lots of honeybees around, right? And they'll be bothering people because they're just as bothersome as wasps. And everyone will be calling them wasps, and they'll be swatting at them and saying, you know, bloody wasps and so on. Yeah. And you look around and you think, actually, these are honeybees. You know, I do a thing where I do public talks, and I stick up pictures and I say, right, what's this? And I put up a picture of a honeybee, and most of the room will say that it's a wasp. So, which is like, ooh. But if you speak to people, they all love honeybees, then you show them a picture of a bumblebee, and that's what they associate as being a honeybee, the big sort of round, friendly kind of furry-looking thing. Actually, I mean, bumblebees are fairly docile, but I have been stung by one, like I said. One of the most painful stings I've had in the UK. But you know, they're not generally aggressive. Actually, wasps aren't generally aggressive either. You know, it's really just towards the end of the season when they're kind of mob-handed. There's quite a lot of them. They're not necessarily getting as much sugar from the colony as they used to, because they usually feed larvae with protein, so insect prey, and then those larvae actually produce sugar, which they kind of regurgitate and the adults can eat. So they've lost this sugar, you know, so they're basically wandering around looking for sugar. And of course, end of the summer, you know, we try to grab the last value out of the summer. The weather's usually nice. We're out with our barbecues and our picnics, and it's a kind of perfect storm of you know, a week or so. And because of that week or so, everything gets, you know, wasps are dreadful, they're terrible. But, you know, wasps are hugely variable. I mean, the solitary wasps, you mentioned earlier, we're interested in the social wasps, you know, those solitary wasps. There's thousands of different species that do all kinds of cool things. So, yeah, it's really just getting people, I think, the vast diversity of the insect world is really hard to get your head around, even when you're aware of it. When you're not aware of it, you know, obviously you're not aware of it. So
yeah, that's true.
Getting people to realise this is, you know, there's so much out there. Yeah, I guess it goes back to what we were talking about earlier about, you know, being kids and playing and seeing insects. You know, once you get your eye in, you realise just how much is out there, and you know how diverse it is, even on our doorstep. You know, there's an Amazon in your back garden if you know how to look.
Yeah, absolutely. Moving on to another animal here, because which is, I would level as similar in regards to social opinion as the wasp. In 2018, your research on spiders got named by Made at Uni as one of the top 100 breakthroughs for its impact on people's lives. What was that research focusing on for spiders?
Yeah, well, that was kind of an interesting one. So we did, with the Royal Society of Biology, back in 2012, we started doing a flying ant survey, which we did for a few years, actually, and came up with a really interesting paper, actually. It was a neat kind of piece of work where we looked at how synchronized they were across the country and sort of flying ant emergencies and stuff. And that went so well that they wanted to do another project on something that people didn't like very much. So we thought, well, let's look at the emergence of spiders in autumn in our houses. Because that's the thing everyone always notices, you know, September, October, it's like hashtag spider season all over. You know, people, suddenly you'll see sort of people going, oh my God, there's like a spider the size of a Jack Russell in my bathroom and stuff. And you see this kind of rising panic among people. And I'll be honest with you, you know, I've occasionally had a little jump when I've got a big house spider, right? So we thought what we'd do, we looked at a few studies, and a few bits of work had been done locally around kind of Yorkshire and stuff, but we thought we'd try and do a nationwide kind of study to see whether this idea of spider season was really a thing or not.
Mm.
And it really took off, actually. I think it helped. We got Zoe Ball did a thing on her program about it, and then Chris Evans talked about it as well. So we ended up with really quite a lot of people downloading this app that we've done.
Yeah.
And we got loads of press for it. The Daily Star. I was foolish, actually, in the press release. I learned my lesson from that. I sort of said in the press release, oh, you know, maybe because we've had such a good summer, there'll be lots of insect prey around, and you know, maybe spiders have got the chance to fulfill their potential. You know, we might see lots of really good sized spiders. And that was sort of interpreted by the Daily Star as like Britain's being invaded by giant spiders. They actually had a front page which was spider. I can remember driving down the road and I saw this petrol station and I was like, oh, well, actually, I wasn't. But other words came into my head at the time. and then it got taken over by, I mean, every single news outlet was covering it. So we got tens of thousands of people downloaded the app, which they were obviously very disappointed with, because it was reported in the press. Basically, people thought they could sort of show the spider, you know, show your phone to a spider, and the app would tell you what the spider was, what species, and it wasn't that at all. So it was, I think, for a while, we were the most downloaded. Like Nature and Science app, and the lowest rated,
because
basically thousands of people were downloading and then going on and reviewing again. This is absolutely rubbish. it's a fair point. It was really just a sort of way of recording, you know, when you'd seen it. So we gathered in loads of data across the country and sort of produced a lot of we produced some papers from it and stuff and some data. But there was just a lot of, you know, we managed to get quite a lot into the press, I think, and in the media, that, you know, spiders weren't as bad as we thought, and we got quite a few nice sort of, you know, it's slowly sort of at least, I'm not going to pretend you're going to turn people into spider lovers, absolutely not, because, you know, a lot of people have a quite innate and quite quite powerful phobic response to them. But at least if you can sort of realize that, well, they, you know, that they are actually really important, they do really cool things. So that was kind of what we hopefully achieved with that research. So yeah, that's what that was all about. But yeah, I fear that sometimes with spiders the message is usually at the end, after a lot of kind of panicky things about false widows and stuff, and then there's like a sentence at the end that says, oh, actually they're not as bad as you think.
And that's the thing with spiders, isn't it? It's because you spend so much work, and many people do. And I you know, we've been involved myself personally with a project, a zoo I used to work at, with releasing a species of water spider back in, you know, into the UK, into an area.
The Rath spiders.
So we did I can't remember, this was some years ago. We might have had a batch of 200 to 300 or something like that, that we were releasing on a protected area. And we thought, what a great opportunity to, you know, get the zoo in the press as, you know, active native conservation work that we're doing. And we did. And my God, did it get spun out of control. Jeez, like... Yeah. It was the first time I think I saw.
Giant spiders.
it's like this zoo is trying to kill your children. It's like, we're really not, Susan. We're just trying to release some spiders back. But it was just. I think it was my first insight of going, wow, the media can spin things. So it was really, as you've just mentioned that there. I think with spiders, it might just be the way it always goes, and the bad news gets. About them gets pushed more, like you said about the false widows and stuff like that. It's just the fear is so easy to spin on people, isn't it? Wonderful. Well, you the other thing I wanted to ask you about was, you once I found this incredible, if it is how I understand it to be, you once delivered a 24-hour lecture, is that correct?
Yeah, I did.
But how was that experience? I mean, I've been on stage for an hour.
Well, I tell you what, I won't do it again. Yeah, it was a foolish thing. It was the first year, I think, or the second year of Biology Week that was run by the Royal Society of Biology, and I can't remember how it came about, but I was talking to the people there, and I said, "Oh no, I could do a 24-hour lecture." They were like, "Oh, brilliant!" So that was like, okay. I thought, okay. So actually, what I did, it was 24 kind of 45-minute sort of sections, so it wasn't continuous, obviously. And the idea was that I started. The evening, it was all about ants and bees and stuff, so we had various different things. I had a few video kind of stuff that I would show as well to give me a break, but during the night there were people there from the Royal Society, but I always had a small crowd, but it was being kind of webcast and stuff. But the idea was, this is kind of a bit of a confession now, but between sort of 3 and kind of 7 o'clock we were supposed to be kind of webcasting to some various schools in places like Singapore, and I think one in Adelaide, and there was one in China as well, but none of the links worked.
Oh no!
And it was quite clear. The thing is, it was quite clear from the beginning, from about 2 o'clock, that this simply wasn't going to happen. I did actually take a small nap between kind of 3 and 7, which actually, you know, if you, anyone that's sort of certainly anyone that's got children or anyone that's spent any time staying up, if you can have a kind of 4 hour sort of sleep cycle, sleep and wake up at kind of not too early, you actually don't feel too bad. So then I kind of plough through the rest of the day. So it was 24 hours, but there was a 4 hour gap when I was beyond my control. I was unable to broadcast. So we ended up taking a little break. But no, we went through the whole thing. The last hour, I got the leaf cutting ants out. So I took a colony down to London, and we had that all kind of laid out, and they were doing their thing. And it was actually, it was quite kind of cool. It was a bit of a manic week, actually. I think I'd been doing something in, then I finished that, and then I had to go and basically catch up on some sleep. Then I took the train to Belgium and did a EU kind of thing, where I was hosting like a science night in Brussels, which was kind of fun. And then I came back from that, and I had something else in London, and I sort of got home, and during that period was also my birthday, which kind of got into the mix. So I can remember getting home that week just thinking, I'm never ever doing this again.
I was going to say, Adam,
it was fun.
When I do the Edinburgh Fringe, the first thing I do is I take a week off, mate. I just try and recoup.
I got back on a Thursday and thought, I think I've had enough this week.
It's important to stop. You said it was focusing, like you said, ants there as well. And am I correct in saying that a lot of the lectures, if not all of them, was focusing on social insects? Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And what does that term, when we say social insect, what does that cover?
Well, it covers, so there's a whole group that's entirely social, so termites, and then you've got all of the ants, they're all social, and then within the bees you've got honeybees and bumblebees and a few other groups of bees like stingless bees that are a bit less well known. You've got social wasps as well, and we're talking about insects that live together in colonies, generally family groups, where you've got the mother and, in the case of termites, also the father kind of present. In ants, bees and wasps, you've only got the queen. And then you've got lots of individuals and she's the reproductive, and then you've got lots of individuals that are workers. They don't reproduce, so they're all slaving away, if you like, for the good of the colony. They're kind of like the cells in our body supporting our, you know, reproductive cells, and then the colony gets bigger and bigger. And at some point, in the case of honeybees, the colony kind of divides off, they produce a new queen, and you get this swarm developing. Or in other things like ants, you get the new queen sort of emerge along with all the males in a big kind of mating swarm, flying ants, which we talked about earlier, and then the colony sort of starts all over again. So it's really those insects that live together permanently in sort of big, meaningful colonies where they sort of cooperate to bring up their brothers and sisters, and they kind of do all that sort of work together and things for the good of the colony. But the main thing is you've got individuals in there which are either not breeding at all, can't breed in some cases, or choose not to, or are breeding to a very small extent, but then you've got other individuals, the queen, that are doing basically most of the reproduction.
Wow. And I mean, I feel like I need to ask you this question. It might be putting you on the spot, but because I really like ants. Ants are one of my favorite animals in regards to just the variety, the style of, you know, the different colonies and stuff like that, and how they all work together. Do you have a favorite species of ant? Which is my favorite question I've ever asked anyone.
I've got my favourite ant. Well, there are a few cool ants. So I guess overall, I'm a big fan of the leaf-cutting ants. So there's about, which mostly of the genus Atus. So there's more than 20 odd species of them that you find in Central and South America. I've got some. They're the only ants I kind of keep in the lab, and they're the ants I started studying in my PhD and things. And they're just very cool. They do incredible things. They, you know, they grow a fungus in the ground that they use as their sort of crop, their agriculture. You know, they produce these massive colonies. You know, I dug one up for a BBC documentary. And it was just, you know, probably 2 million workers in there. You know, they're just huge, great, impressive things. They do, every time you look at them, you see something else and you think, God, you could spend the rest of your life just studying, you know, that. So they're pretty cool. But probably, like, in terms of, if you like a looker, I really like, there's a big ant that I've studied in Brazil. It's called Dinopona quadriceps, and it's just, I think it's the biggest ant in the world. You know, it's about 2.5 centimeters long and just shy of
it. Oh, wow.
And they're black, they look like it, you know, you close your eyes and you think of a sort of an ant, it's kind of what comes into mind is this sort of thing. And they're just big and they've got a sting, but they're not particularly aggressive or anything, and they live in quite small colonies, you know, 50 or 60 70 80 kind of workers. But they've got this really cool thing where they don't have a queen. They, along with a bunch of other ants, they secondarily lost the queen, so they form basically all the workers, if you like, all the individuals could become a reproductive. And they kind of, one of them is, and they're sort of the mother, if you like, the queen, in inverted commas, of the colony. But then you've got this kind of little Game of Thrones thing going on where you've got four or five other ants that are in this sort of hierarchy to sort of take over. And they're always testing each other. And they're kind of fighting and interacting. Sometimes they'll test the sort of the gamma gate, as she's called, the breeding worker, the queen, in inverted commas. And, you know, sometimes the queen decides that she's had enough and she'll smear them with a special chemical that causes the other workforce to come over and beat them up and kill them, actually, in some cases. And it's this weird thing because you have a big tray of them. You know, they live in kind of plaster of Paris trays. You can have a glass top on them and see them. And you sort of, you can speak to people and go, oh, these ants, you know, they're wonderful and they're cooperative and they live in these harmonious societies, and they go, okay. And then you lift off the top and you look in, and there's like about 15% of the ants are tearing lumps out of each other. And, you know, there's this kind of weird sort of dominance hierarchy going on. And it really makes you realise that, you know what, very few things are quite as you think they are. And actually you find these sorts of conflicts in lots of systems. Even honeybees, you know, have these kind of conflicts going on about egg laying and all sorts of other stuff. So they're kind of up there too. I like them. They're buggers to get out of the ground. They live in really hard, sun-baked kind of soil in Brazil. Brazil. They're often really deep. I can remember digging this hole that was about 2 meters deep across the course of about half a day with a French guy that I was out there with, and we still didn't get the colony. And we realised that it was much, much more better use of our time really to pay to collect the colonies. And so we did, and we sat in our hotel for 2 weeks and enjoyed the sun and the local rum, and every day these kids would appear with the colonies that we had the permit to collect. So it was a useful bit of field work.
That's amazing. As well,
they're really cool.
They can get that deep, and there's only, did you say, about 60 to 70 in a colony?
Yeah, they're really, I think, I'm guessing, and we don't know much about what they do in the wild, actually, in terms of how they produce new colonies. You know, we know that they bud off kind of like small-scale swarming and stuff, but we don't know a lot. And I wonder whether they use, kind of find a tunnel system and then they reuse it and dig out some themselves, and whether these things are actually really quite old. And there are ways that you could study that, looking at kind of fluorescence and stuff, so you could date the sort of layers and things. I'm sure there's all kinds of fancy techniques, but I do wonder, because you look at them, they're spending quite a lot of time sort of beating up with each other. And you know, they have to go and do other ant stuff like forage and all that kind of stuff. And so you look at these sort of massively deep nests and you do wonder exactly where they find the time.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm guessing that they do that. I also think we got very unlucky with that first colony, and it was incredibly deep, because I saw some of the holes the kid left behind, and they weren't quite so big, but they were still pretty impressive, actually.
Yeah, I mean, that's incredible at 2 meters deep, and like, even for just if it was a one-off, that's still pretty impressive. Yeah. It wasn't there.
Although, so there's some fantastic things online, YouTubes of people that have poured. There's a guy called Walter Schinkel who's particularly good at pouring dental cement into ant nests and digging them up, and even just, you know, regular pavement ants, if you like, you know, common garden ants in different parts of the world that you kind of don't think twice about, and they duck down a hole. Actually, when you look at their excavations, it can be really impressive. There's a picture of him standing next to one that's taller than he is, going down through the soil with all these kind of culverts and sort of bits coming off, and you know, it's like a mine system down there. And it makes you realize actually how important ants are. There's this big thing about ants are great for cycling nutrients and bringing stuff down from the top and aerating soil, and you think, yeah, okay, yeah, whatever, but then you see this, the sort of the structures they produce, you start to realize actually, you know what, they really do.
Yeah, that's incredible. My last question to you, and this is something that again I ask all the guests that I have on the show when we do our interviews, if you could pass on one bit of advice to the generation of today, or pretty much everyone in regards to the natural world, what would you pass on?
I would say get involved with stuff. Right? Say yes to stuff. Mm-hmm. Right? If you want to get out there, get involved, do things. If someone says, do you want to come and see this? Yeah, of course you do. Right? Of course you want to go and see something cool. You know, just get stuck in. There's lots of opportunities to get involved. There's lots of organisations that are desperate for, you know, volunteers to get involved. Desperate for people to just. That are engaged with there's all kinds of citizen science things you can get involved with. There's all kinds of other things that you can do. So I mean, if you're into birds, yeah, we need people to do bird ringing, for example. That's a very skilled, a very difficult job, and you need to have incredible skill base to do it, not just in terms of the handling of the birds, but working out what sex the birds are and aging them. I mean, it's just remarkable. When you know, people that know birds, they know birds, and you know, that's incredible. We've got people that are county recorders for all the insect groups. There are lots of specialist groups, particularly in the UK. You know, we're really lucky. We've got all kinds of, I mean, you know, amateurs is the sort of name for them, but we use that in a very pejorative way. Actually, amateur, you know, means lover, you know, and we have these amazing amateur organizations that go out and they record lichen and